This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Nope, I am not going to do it. I am not going to make that fly the friendly skies joke y'all are waiting for. But oh yeah, we are going to talk about it from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 10th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. United and that video coming up in just a bit. But we are going to start today with tax policy and American manufacturing. Toyota announced today, and yes, I know that's a Japanese company, but hang on. Toyota says it's going to put a bit more than $1.3 billion into its plant in Georgetown, Kentucky. They make Camrys there and a bunch of other models. It's the biggest factory Toyota has anywhere on the planet. Other car makers, Volvo and BMW among them, are investing in plants in the southern United States as well. Spending that comes as Washington contemplates corporate tax reform. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
Toyota is investing $1.3 billion to upgrade 30-year-old equipment at its manufacturing plant in Georgetown, Kentucky. The factory is going to start producing a new Camry in June. Will James is president of the plant and says this investment has been in the works for years and was not driven by the border tax floated by President Trump.
Automobile manufacturing is the type of business that you have to kind of plan ahead on the things that you're going to do.
But like executives at other foreign automakers, he's quick to point out that a border tax could add to the price of a car. In Toyota's case, up to $2,500.
So those costs would just be passed on to the consumers. And with that in mind, you know, we obviously have concerns.
Jessica Caldwell from Edmunds.com says these auto industry investments aren't a spur-of-the-moment thing. Let's say an automaker wants to build a new plant.
A lot of negotiations have to take place at the state level. A lot of auto plants get tax credits. You know, they have to guarantee a labor force.
And factories are a long-term investment. Kristen Gichek works for the Center for Automotive Research.
A plant lasts 50, 60, 70 years. So it far outlasts any president, any set of policies.
She says that means the auto industry probably won't be making any billion-dollar decisions based on border tax legislation that hasn't even been introduced yet. That doesn't mean foreign automakers won't take the opportunity to highlight where they are investing and to argue against a border tax. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Staying on transportation here for a minute, two giant trucking companies announced a big merger today, $5.1 billion big. You pass their rigs on the road every day, I bet. Swift and Knight, both out of Phoenix, Arizona. The interesting thing is that the deal's getting done as trucking has hit a bit of a slowdown, as Sally Herships reports.
The trucking industry is having trouble getting into gear.
The biggest thing is we're kind of in a lull right now.
Eric Starks is CEO of Freight Transportation Research, an industry analysis firm. He says a merger helps both companies cut costs. Business has been flat the past 2 years.
We saw where the economy started to stall out somewhat. We saw that a lot of the customer base added too much inventory.
Stark says the trucking industry's customers are manufacturers. They order raw materials, stuff to make everything from washing machines to breakfast cereal. They order too much. That means they need fewer deliveries. Deborah Lockridge is editor-in-chief of Heavy Duty Trucking Magazine.
trucking is not a high-margin business in the first place.
So there aren't a lot of places in the business to make cuts. Thus, this merger and other recent deals. Lockridge says government regulations have also forced the industry to spend more to meet emission standards,
which are great for clean air and for climate change, but have resulted in equipment being ever more expensive, and in some cases not only more expensive to buy, but sometimes more expensive to maintain.
More frequent diesel filter changes, for one. Lockridge says another big expensive change is coming this year, electronic tracking to make sure drivers stick to the daily driving hours they're allowed. The merger gives Knight and Swift access to more drivers and more trucks. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
In financial industry news today, this item, a special committee of the board of directors at Wells Fargo has decided that former CEO John Stumpf, remember he resigned in the aftermath of that fake account scandal last year, Stumpf is going to have to give back another $28 million in compensation for his role in that episode. That's on top of $41 million that was clawed back when Stumpf retired in October. New York State has become the first to approve a free college plan for middle-class families. A $153 billion budget deal reached in Albany last night is going to cover tuition at the state's public colleges and universities for families earning up to $125,000 a year. Tuition, though, as any family paying for school knows all too well, is just part of the bill. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
By 2019, any New York student with a certain GPA and course load will qualify for free public tuition if their family's annual income is $125,000 or less. Why $125,000?
It covers certainly the middle class at the end of the day, and those are the families who have been squeezed by rising tuition.
Mark Huelsman is a senior policy analyst at Demos. The program only covers expenses left over after federal and other grants run out. Beth Akers with the Manhattan Institute says it doesn't do much for lower-income families.
Students who are from the lowest-income households in New York State are already going to college at very deeply discounted tuition prices or even for free in many instances.
And the scholarship does not cover room and board. Mark Cohen is president of the SUNY Student Assembly.
Room and board at the State University of New York, an incredibly affordable system of public higher education, it can still be twice as much as tuition itself.
Overall, he calls the plan a spectacular step in the right direction. But Richard Garassi, president of the private Wagner College on Staten Island, says if tuition-free public college catches on,
this will drive lots of students out of the private sector into the public sector where there's not enough capacity and not adequate funding.
The program sets aside $19 million to help students pay for private colleges. But here's the catch. After graduation, recipients have to stay in New York for as many years as they received the scholarship. If they take a job out of state, the grant would convert to a loan. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So here's what happened in a tiny little corner of Wall Street today. Consumers saw that United video and said, that is terrible. Traders saw it and said, hey, United is way overbooked, selling lots of tickets. That's great. UAL up 0.9% at the bell. The major indices mostly unchanged. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You might think that once your fanny is firmly settled in seat 27D, that seat is yours till you get where you're going. United Airlines, however, begs to differ. You have surely seen or heard of by now the video of a United passenger being forcibly removed from an overbooked Chicago to Louisville, Kentucky flight yesterday. It is one for the Public Relations Nightmares Hall of Fame. Robert Mann is a consultant, too, and a former executive at airlines in this country. Mr. Mann, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks, Guy. Nice to be here with you.
Quick and dirty, if you could. What is overbooking and why do airlines do it?
Overbooking is the selling of more seats in the reservation process than the airline expects to have on the aircraft that operates that flight that day. So I may sell 110 seats on a 100-seat aircraft on any given day.
So to the case at hand today, Chicago, the Chicago flight, just because you have a ticket doesn't mean you're entitled to a seat on the airplane.
That's correct. If you take the time to read the airline condition of contract that you're planning to travel on, not that anyone does, by the way, because it's 10-point mice type that only lawyers probably read or approved, it does, in fact, say that the carrier has the final right to allow you to travel or not for what may either be marketing or operational reasons.
Can you recall an overbooking situation having gotten physically violent, I guess you have to call this, in the past?
No, not to this extent. I have certainly witnessed difficult oversale situations that involved the need to negotiate in all capital letters with customers.
Yeah.
And in fairness to United or United Express, whichever it was, actually, this appears to have been a last-minute operational need to move crew members on a flight to Louisville in order to operate another flight. So the Hobson's choice in this case was, I either remove four customers from this aircraft, it turns out three of them consensually or in exchange for value, and one unconsensually, involuntarily, or I cause a flight in Louisville, which might have 70 or more customers on it, not to operate.
Right.
So it was a difficult decision under any circumstances and done under time pressure because the aircraft has to depart reasonably close to time, if not actually on time. And so all this is done as the clock is ticking.
United apparently stopped its negotiations, small letters in this case, at $800 that they were offering people to get on this plane, off this plane. Why not go to, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 rather than the what has to be, say, horrible, horrible, horrible publicity of this video now showing them dragging a passenger off the plane?
Sure. It evokes the 1970s Fram oil filters commercial. You can pay me now or you can pay me later. and that's indeed what's going to happen here. United will probably pay at the Department of Transportation. They will pay probably to the customer, and they have certainly paying in the court of public opinion.
Well, CEO Oscar Munoz came out with a statement today in which he said, and I quote, "I apologize for having to reaccommodate these customers," end of quote. That's not going to win United any fans.
No, that was airline-ese when a common sense apology was what was warranted here.
Right. Any reason then to believe that this is going to change?
Well, I think what clearly will change is the both the process and the art of that negotiation. United clearly should be getting involved with it. It's kind of a teaching moment. You hate to have episodes like this be that fodder for teaching moments, but they often are.
Robert Mann, airline industry consultant, former airline executive as well. Mr. Mann, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Congress stands in recess for the next couple of weeks, so we're going to have to wait and see what might or might not happen with health care. But the economy waits for no one, so the White House and Speaker Ryan figure out what they want to do. Small businesses are stuck dealing with big policy uncertainties. From our help desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that one.
Working up a sweat in slacks and a button-down, Dr. Scott Brelo pries open a 3x5 wood crate.
What's in there?
My exam table.
That's Dr. Vicky Brelo. The couple's less than a month out from opening up their joint primary care office. Until now, Vicky co-owned a practice downtown where she voluntarily offered her employees insurance.
1 year, I'm paying $650 for family policy, and then the following year, I'm paying $1,150 a month for a policy. That's a really, really big deal.
Vicky's old business is one of nearly 2 million nationwide that employs 3 to 9 workers, and by far the group of companies most vulnerable to Obamacare premium spikes. The law mandates more robust plans covering things like people with pre-existing conditions and maternity benefits. That makes policies more expensive. Vicky had hoped Republicans in Washington would do something to bring those costs back down, making it cheaper to staff up her new business.
Most small business owners run things pretty bare bones. We're not like huge firms that have like donuts in the waiting. You know, it's not like that. I don't know where I would cut it back. You know, turn the heat down more during office hours, or, you know, at what point do you just say we got to take the big expense and make a cut to it? And that's healthcare.
Now, Vicky and everybody else is on hold. Until whatever happens next in Congress happens, a whole lot of small employers will continue to push for Obamacare's repeal. The National Federation of Independent Business endorsed the Republicans' plan, arguing that it would have delivered more predictability and lowered costs. But other business groups, like the Main Street Alliance, want the GOP to fix Obamacare, not let it explode. Remember, company owners are both employers and individuals.
For us, it just means that we're able to not spend $20,000, $30,000 a year on health care, and that's money that you can put into your business.
Ashley Montague owns the Penn Book Center. Obamacare cut their family premium in half initially, and all of the guaranteed coverage, the same stuff that drove premiums up for Vicky, was a huge relief for them. Her husband, Michael Rowe, says it's given them peace of mind at a time when the threat of Amazon forces them to restructure their business.
You know, so we have plans that we can grow, but the idea that we could do that is dependent on the ACA.
Rowe says income will slip enough that the family should qualify for insurance subsidies next year. Different businesses have their different Obamacare stories.
The big issue is the costs continue to go up, and every year that chips into an employer's budget.
That's Matt Ray with the Kaiser Family Foundation. More than 10 years before Obamacare, Ray says small business owners started walking away from providing coverage. In 2000, 66% of businesses with 3 to 49 workers offered benefits. Today, it's eroded to 53%. Ray says the ACA didn't really impact that trend. For 30 years, the Federation of Independent Business says the cost of health insurance has been members' number one concern. That cost, not Obamacare, is the main character in this story. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's not what jobs robots are going to steal. It's that their people aren't going to be ready to do the jobs that they need to do.
Robot-proof jobs. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is basically unchanged today, 20,658. The NASDAQ up 3 points, barely changed there as well, 5880. S&P 500 up about a point, 2357. A whole lot of nothing going on. We mentioned Toyota and that $1.3 billion it's plowing into its Georgetown, Kentucky plant. Something, it has to be said, plant president has been planned for years. Toyota up 1.1% today. Fiat Chrysler slowed down about 0.3%. Elsewhere in airlines, other than United, Southwest descended 0.5%. Today, American Airlines gained about 1.2%. We mentioned Wells Fargo, stock there down about 0.5%. Bank of America slipped about 0.6%. Goldman Sachs deposited 0.4% to the good. Bond prices, well, thanks for asking. They were up. Yield on the 10-year T-notes thus fell to 2.36%. And you, yes, yeah, you, right there. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
On our podcast, Make Me Smart, we ask our guests this.
What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
If you play by the rules, you win.
Hard lessons from Elevest CEO Sally Krawchuk. Stunning realizations, though, from TV legend Norman Lear.
I wouldn't have said that I was capable of murder.
Trust me, you got to hear that story.
Yeah. And of course, a really important lesson about livestock from the CEO of Reddit.
I thought that a pony was a baby horse.
Turns out it's not. It's just a small horse. Come join the conversation at marketplace.org/makemesmart.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We do a series every now and then called My Economy, your personal stories of trying to get by out there that we put on the radio. Today's installment comes to us from Seattle, Washington. It's a little bit personal, a little bit professional.
My name is Hannah Palin. I am the Film Archives Specialist at the University of Washington Library Special Collections. I take care of all the film and videotape that is held by my department. Newsreels, home movies, educational films, some documentaries. Ruth and Louis Kirk Moving Image Collection was a large group of films that came to us.
But the morning offered China blue sky and calm water, answered prayers for canoeists.
You end up taking these great journeys where I personally
I'm probably not going to canoe through Yellowstone, and I'm not going to do that kind of hiking, but to go with them, I feel like I get to enjoy it with them. The thing that I love about the work that I do is that I get to preserve a part of our past. Moving images, because they're so new, there's not a line item in a lot of institutional organizations that, oh, of course we know that we need a moving image archivist. So one of the ways that to fund the work that has to be done is by writing grants and by looking for private funding. And that's how I have been paid here at the University of Washington for 12 of my 15 years. I think the thing that worries me the most about losing funding for this kind of work is that it stops the whole process. It just goes on a shelf and it dies, and that knowledge dies along with it.
Hannah Palin, up in Seattle, Washington. Take a second, would you, and tell us your story. There's a place you can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Five years ago, my colleague David Brancaccio, now the host of the Marketplace Morning Report, took a little road trip, New Jersey to San Francisco, in search of what's known as technological unemployment, jobs that people don't have anymore because robots do. He didn't interact with a single human being on that whole trip, if I remember right. Now, though, a fresh journey seeking out what we're calling robot-proof jobs, starting today with the most robot-proof career of them all. Here's David.
Arachnophobes need not be afraid of this robot.
And then the legs, there's a controller that basically figures out, okay, where are the legs now? Where do they need to go to basically keep myself balanced? So I can drive it around. I can go up. I can go down.
Skittering around like a spider the size of a bicycle wheel. Keep telling yourself that this robot is a hexapod, just six, not eight legs. 5 years ago, when I last spoke with Dave Rawlinson here in Pittsburgh, he was a graduate student in robotics at nearby Carnegie Mellon University. Back then, Dave was studying snake robots for search and rescue. Well, look at him now. Dave is co-founder of a firm called Hebi Robotics. It makes an electronic building block that can be the shoulder, elbow, or knee of almost any robot you'd care to construct.
Kind of modular building blocks is what we're calling these. We're kind of inspired by Lego. We want to get to the point where people can put these together as easily and intuitively as Lego.
Just add bits of tube, springs, and foot pads, and voila, custom robot. If not spider-like, then crab-like as it pounds the pavement with its clever little legs. Since we first met, a lot's been going on with Dave, originally from the little town of Clifton Forge in southwest Virginia. He's now Dr. Dave, PhD, he's become a father, and he's given birth to this tech company with all the complexities of any startup.
You're taking off a plane like while you're building the runway underneath it. It is that kind of level of stress.
But listen to his biggest worry. It's finding people who have the right skills so he can hire them.
You've like whittled your set down to probably like a handful of people in the world that can really do what it is you're trying to do. And there's no way around it being like a slow, detailed process, but it is probably our number one concern as we grow is just finding the right people.
Across town at Dave's alma mater, they see it this way too.
This is the real concern. It's not what jobs robots are going to steal. It's that the people aren't going to be ready to do the jobs that they need to do.
David Bourne is principal systems scientist at CMU's Robotics Institute. He's taken me into one of his labs, a big open bay. It's like that scene in every James Bond movie where you meet Q, the inventor. Only it's a graduate student doing the work today.
So here's Q's assistant, who's actually the real worker. He's Mabaran. He's awesome.
Mabaran Rajaraman is running a prototype robot that can recognize and manipulate big pieces, for instance, girders on a construction site. Bourne says you can't have more people with robotics jobs if there aren't enough professors of robotics to teach them. Many potential teachers are being swallowed up by industry, like Uber, which hired away a bunch of faculty here to work on self-driving cars.
Just to give you an example, in one of our programs, we had 600 applications and there were 40 spots. That should give you a pause. You know, there's a lot of people that can't do the field they want to do.
It was just what I was passionate about. I loved math. And I did math competitions on the Math Olympiad. And I was raised in a country where math is like our national sport, right?
Anca Dragan, originally from Romania, is another student I met 5 years ago. Back in 2012, when she was still a grad student at CMU, I teased her, asking if her parents worry she'll ever find meaningful employment with those engineering credentials. Well, she has landed on her feet. I'm speaking to her at her office in Berkeley, California, where she is now a UC professor in the Electrical Engineering and Computer Sciences Department. Her parents, happy, finally?
They say, why did you not accept the Stanford offer?
But they must have been very proud of you.
They were, yes, absolutely.
Her research now centers on the relationship, call it the tango, between humans and robots, which can also be engineered to communicate their intentions nonverbally. I love the story about her early inspiration, a book she came across in high school about artificial intelligence, co-authored by Berkeley professor Stuart Russell, which prompted her to embark on a career of the future, if there ever was one.
Now I get to be a colleague of Stuart's, and he's just a few offices away. So it's really interesting to think of where I was in 12th grade and sort of the luck that I have now.
Well, luck in the sense of you can help make your own luck, but also the luck of being born in a country, Romania, with a culture that honors math and science achievements. Human math ability, with the tech skills that follow from it, gives people access to some of the best jobs of the future. I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
David's got more robot-proof jobs on the Marketplace Morning Report all week, as well as a special podcast. You can get that at marketplace.org/robotproof. Also, while you're there, try our quiz. Which jobs do you think are the most and least vulnerable to automation? Check it out. This final note on the way out today, some good news for the airline traveling public. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai announced today that he is not down with cell phone use on airplanes. Back in 2013, you might remember, under different leadership, the FCC started talking about letting people use their phones in flight, like to talk on, probably loudly. Today, in asking his fellow commissioners to join him, Pai said this, quote, "Taking it off the table permanently will be a victory for Americans across the country who, like me, value a moment of quiet at 30,000 feet," end of quote. Unchanged is the Wall Street word of the day today for all three major indices. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.